long. Martin spent a little time at the computer, getting Roy set up in the shell. Then Martin announced that it was time to go. There had been some unpleasantness a while back, and now he and a few of his wizard friends were making a point of getting together once a week to compare notes and share new shell scripts they'd devised that could be used in an emergency. He brought Roy along so he could meet the guys and see what kind of things they'd been working on. Having worked in the defense industry, he might find it interesting. Martin and Roy materialized in the middle of a large clearing about 5 miles away from Leadchurch. Martin's friend Gary had picked it because it was large, flat, and surrounded by thick woods on all sides. The wizards had all the room they needed to demonstrate and test new spells without having to worry about any locals sneaking up on them. Even if someone did sneak up on them from the forest, that person would have to move amazingly fast to reach the middle of the clearing before the wizards could react. Martin, in his silver robe and hat, staff in hand, and Roy, wearing his trench coat, skinny tie, and sensible shoes, stood alone in the middle of the field. Martin spun around, then said,
"Oh no."
A gray shape emerged from the tree line, moving amazingly fast. Two more shapes, one purple, one black, were closing on their position from other directions. Martin remembered Gary proposing a new plan to keep each other on their toes. He called it the Cato Protocol. It was a simple idea. The wizards would attack one another without any provocation or warning. It would ensure that they all stayed in fighting shape. It would force them to be aware of their surroundings. And most important, from Gary's point of view, it would be fun.
"Sounds good," Martin had said. "When do we start?"
"We'll see,"
had been Gary's reply. The streaks of color were almost on top of them when Martin yelled,
"Time out!"
The streaks stopped in midair, floating motionless in a rough triangle around Martin and Roy. Tyler's purple robes hung beneath him, flapping slightly in the breeze. The sun glinted off of the Rolls-Royce hood ornament that topped his staff. Jeff landed, tucking his wand into the pocket of his gray flannel robe. Gary drifted around in front of Martin and Roy. His long, scraggly brown hair jutted out from around his jet-black hat. Beneath the hem of his black robe, his skinny legs and black canvas high tops hung 5 feet above the turf. He pointed the head of his staff, adorned with KISS action figures, toward Roy, and said,
"Hey, Martin, good to see you. Who's the new guy?"
"Gary, Tyler, Jeff, this is Roy, my trainee. He just arrived last night. He doesn't have any powers yet and doesn't know what's going on, so it would be really unfair to attack him."
Despite his clear age difference and uptight demeanor, the three younger wizards welcomed Roy in a genuinely friendly manner. Martin was relieved to note that despite Roy's age, cultural background, and year of origin, he didn't seem to miss a beat when introduced to Tyler, who was possibly the only black man in England at this time in history. They all agreed that they couldn't attack him, since he couldn't really defend himself. Jeff said,
"I could explain to him what's going on, though."
"Good thinking,"
Tyler said, still floating in an aggressive posture.
"That'll free Martin up to be attacked."
"And us to attack him,"
Gary added.
Martin said, "Fair enough."
He blurted out the magic word floogie and was off for the tree line like a shot. As he streaked away, a shiny silver ball of speed, he faintly heard Jeff talking to Roy. Martin thought Roy and Jeff would have much to talk about, both being engineers. Martin made a mental note to work on some sort of fast getaway sprint spell to help him really accelerate when he needed to fly away from trouble. Some sort of glowing projectiles flew past Martin, striking the ground in front of him. Martin chose to ignore them, figuring that, like bullets, they were only his problem if they hit him. Martin made it to the tree line with Tyler in hot pursuit. Gary, who had been slower to react, chose to go over the trees and try to head Martin off at the pass, so to speak. Now the pass was in sight. Martin could see a dark shape hanging above the trees, clearly watching him, waiting for him to emerge from the woods. Unless he did something fast, Gary would almost certainly hit him with something. He didn't know what, but knowing Gary, it would be something unpleasant and probably immature. Happily, Martin had been working on a few ideas. He had that big workspace in his warehouse. It'd be a crime not to use it. Martin reached into his pocket and pulled out a small black beanbag. He aimed for a gap in the trees with empty space beyond, looked behind him at Tyler, who was closing fast, slowed a bit, then he tossed the beanbag over his shoulder. It flew in a graceful arc, sailing over Tyler, missing him completely. Martin made a grasping gesture with his right hand and said, "Bamf!" Martin disappeared in a puff of black smoke, which violently dissipated when Tyler flew through it. In the same instant, Martin appeared directly behind Tyler, generating another puff of black smoke. It appeared as if he had materialized and miraculously caught the beanbag. But in truth, his right hand had materialized around the beanbag and the rest of it with him. Martin stopped all forward movement and watched as Tyler flailed, utterly confused by what had just happened. He sailed out of the woods and instantly was struck by a pulse of energy from above. Gary had clearly mistaken Tyler for Martin. For a moment, Tyler spun in the air. Something clearly was wrong. Then Martin saw that a small grayish object of some sort was stuck to the small of Tyler's back, right where he'd been hit. Purple smoke started shooting from the object with quite a bit of force, enough to push Tyler into an uncontrollable spin. The smoke was accompanied by a sound, similar to the sound of a whoopee cushion, but much louder and longer in duration. The purple smoke also had an odor. The odor was familiar and not at all pleasant. Tyler spun in the air like a foul-smelling pinwheel. The whoopee cushion sound was drowned out momentarily by the sound of Tyler cursing at Gary. The thrust from the whoopee rocket stabilized slightly and sent Tyler corkscrewing helplessly into the sky, yelling and cursing as he went. Martin dropped gently to the ground and crouched there in the thicket. He tucked his staff under his left arm and wound up so that he'd be ready to throw his beanbag. Cautiously, Gary dropped below the tree line, looking for Martin. He hovered, staff in one hand, the other hand shading his eyes so he could see into the darkened forest. He expected to find Martin flying above the ground, but it didn't take long to spot Martin's shiny silver robe and hat in the dark brown and green of the woods. It also didn't take long to notice the black object flying very quickly towards him. The beanbag struck Gary painlessly in the chest. A split second later, Martin was there, grasping Gary around the neck with one arm, pulling down with all of his weight. Gary toppled over forward. He found himself beneath Martin, who pushed off from him with both feet, driving him even faster into the ground. Gary hit the ground with great force, while Martin drifted down gently to earth. Gary lay motionless for a moment in the scrub grass along the riverbank, eyes closed, gathering his strength, hopefully luring Martin in closer. After a carefully timed interval, Gary sprung up into a three-point crouch, his staff held in front of him. His defiant laugh was made less dramatic by the fact that he misjudged Martin's location and had sprung up facing away from Martin. Gary felt something soft hit him in the back, heard Martin say, "Bamf!" then felt Martin's full weight bear down on his back, buckling his arm and forcing him back into the dirt. "You done?" Martin asked, standing on Gary's back as he lay prone in the dirt.
"Yeah, I guess,"
was Gary's muffled reply. Martin stepped off of his friend and gave him a hand up. He didn't mention that Gary had two big, dusty footprints on the back of his robe, and he hoped nobody else would tell him either. They turned their attention to Tyler, who was still creating foul, purple curlicues in the sky. Gary muttered something under his breath, and the smoke and noise let out one last, powerful trumpet blast, then stopped. Tyler remained motionless, a dot in the sky, for a moment while he composed himself. When he was ready, he flew to Martin and Gary's position, landing in front of them, glaring at Gary the entire time. After a thick, velvety silence, Tyler asked Gary,
"When will this smell come out of my robe?"
Gary said,
as soon as you figure out how to make it come out. Sorry.
You will be,
Tyler said. He then turned his attention to Martin.
So, what's up with the old guy?
They were amazed to hear that Roy was from the year 1973, or as Gary put it, pre-Star Wars. Martin told them about how Roy had arrived the night before, copped an attitude, then settled down eventually. He hoped Roy wasn't giving Jeff a hard time. Jeff could be a little sensitive. They took to the air to reconnect with Jeff and Roy. Martin was relieved to find them sitting in the grass, Jeff listening in rapt attention as Roy told him about what it was like to work at the Skunk Works. Now that the pleasantries and the combat were over, they all formally demonstrated the new defensive power they'd brought to share. Gary described what he called his gas jets, which he'd accidentally used on Tyler. Tyler demonstrated his spell by deliberately using it on Gary. Tyler shot him in the back with one of the same glowing bolts Martin had seen whiz past him during their chase. As soon as it hit Gary, he was lifted into the air. Gary swung and lolled sickeningly in space. Clearly, he had no ability to stabilize himself. He was also visibly vibrating as he hung in space, helpless.
Why?
Gary whined in a goat-like wavering tone. Tyler walked toward the helpless wizard. He grabbed Gary's leg, stopping his motion. Gary said,
Thanks.
Tyler said,
You're welcome.
And gave him a good hearty spin.
I'm sure this looks familiar to you all, Tyler said. The spell lifts the victim 3 feet into the air, drops him, then places him right back there 3 feet above the ground. It does this 10 times a second. The result is that the target is helpless and has no attitude control, although in this case the target had never been able to control his attitude in the first place.
Gary told Tyler to shut up. Tyler shoved Gary with all his might, sending him gliding away from the group, yelling plaintively the whole way. Tyler continued.
Also, the vibration humiliates the target and almost instantly gives him a splitting headache.
Roy asked,
Why would you think that would look familiar to us?
Oh, Tyler said. Sorry, Roy. I forgot you were so new. It's based on a spell Martin invented and used in front of all us wizards once.
Roy turned to Martin.
You invented that? Kiddo, that's diabolical.
Martin shrugged and said,
Yeah, well, I hope never to have to use it again.
Jeff started to say that this was because Martin had created the spell for his own use, as a crude and utterly failed attempt at a flying spell, but Martin shot him a look that stopped him before he started. In the distance, a weak, warbling voice said,
Tyler, please stop this!
Tyler yelled,
Stop it yourself! Any other spell will override it.
Gary said the magic word floogie and instantly drifted slowly into the sky, where he hung limply for a moment. Jeff called out,
Hey, Gary, you okay?
Gary held up one finger, as if asking for a moment to compose himself. He pointed the finger at Tyler and said,
Excuse veen.
A ball of light streaked from his finger. He was far enough away that Tyler had time to react. He hiked up on his wizard staff and swung it like a baseball bat. The silver Rolls-Royce hood ornament traced a glowing arc in the air. The staff connected with the glowing ball, which dissipated on impact. Tyler paused at the end of his follow-through, then craned his head to look at the end of his staff. There, just under the hood ornament, was another of Gary's gas jets. After a half second of silence, the gas jet fired. Martin, Roy, and Jeff all ran as Tyler spun violently, trying to keep his grip on his staff. Soon Tyler was invisible, at the center of a foul-smelling cloud of purple vapor. The wavering sound of the jet and the occasional glint of high-speed chrome were the only indications of the violent activity within the cloud. Finally, Tyler either let go or lost his grip, Either way, his staff soared off into the distance, whirling like a helicopter blade and leaving a purple contrail in its wake. Tyler lay in the grass on his back. Gary approached and offered him a hand up. As he hoisted Tyler to his feet, he said,
"We're even."
"For now," Tyler replied.
Roy shook his head and asked,
"Are you boys sure these spells are meant for self-defense, or are they just designed to help you humiliate each other?"
Gary answered,
"I think a really good spell ought to be able to do both."
At that moment, a subtle, warbling, repetitive chiming noise filled the air. The wizards all cocked their heads to the side. Jeff asked,
"Okay, whose hand is that?"
Everyone but Roy looked at his right hand. Martin said,
"Oh, it's me."
Martin lifted his hand in front of his face. A small, semi-transparent image of Philip's head appeared in the palm of Martin's hand.
"Martin," Philip said, "I need you to come to my shop right now."
"Why?"
Martin asked.
"What is it?"
"I don't know for sure, but I need you to help me figure it out."
Martin said,
"I'll be right there."
Gary leaned in behind Martin's shoulder.
"We'll all be right there."
Philip rolled his eyes.
"Is it too late to say that I want you to come alone?"
Martin said,
"I'll come alone."
Gary said,
"We'll all come alone."
6. Moments later, Philip's private sanctuary was crowded with wizards. Philip liked to call it his inner sanctum. All the other wizards called it his rumpus room. Martin asked what was going on. Philip pointed to his wet bar. Sitting on the bar, there was a large salad bowl, the most beautiful salad bowl in the world. It was a perfect half-sphere, made of the thinnest, clearest glass Martin had ever seen. The bowl was kept upright by 3 impossibly perfect, clear glass dolphins that acted as legs.
"Where do you get that?"
Martin asked, approaching the salad bowl.
"The bottom of the stairs," Philip said. "I was tending to some important chairman business, and I heard a ringing noise. I went to investigate. I found that. There was no note, and before anybody asks, I checked, and the phrase, 'So long and thanks for all the fish,' isn't engraved anywhere on it."
"So someone left it there and rang a bell to get your attention?"
Jeff asked.
"No. You know nobody can get up in here without my permission. That's why Gary's waiting downstairs."
Philip looked at the floor and yelled,
"Having fun down there, Gary?"
A muffled voice answered,
"No."
Tyler asked,
"So, what made the ringing noise?"
Philip reached into the bowl and pulled out a glass disc about the size of a coaster. But again, it was the most breathtakingly clear and beautiful glass coaster Martin had ever seen. Philip held it a couple of inches above the bottom of the bowl, then let it go. When it struck the bottom, it created a loud, clear, yet somehow soft tone that filled the room. Philip said,
"I figure whoever sent them put the bowl there first, then sent the disc a few inches above it to get my attention."
He handed the disc to Martin.
"Now, to get your attention, I'll ask you to take a look at this."
Martin held the disc up to the light. It weighed less than he expected, and was cold to the touch. As he turned it in the light, Martin saw that it was etched with some sort of pictogram. It showed 2 figures in pointy hats, standing, facing each other. Between them they held a large half-circle, each supporting it with both hands. In the middle of the half-circle, Martin could make out a circle that he was sure symbolized the glass disc in his hand. Beneath the 2 figures, there were words. It was hard to read such small, fine print, etched so lightly on a transparent background, but Martin immediately recognized that the words were the names Philip and Martin.
"So, Philip, what do you think?"
Martin asked. Philip said,
"If they were trying to hurt me, they'd have just sent a bomb or something."
"Unless they wanted to hurt both of us," Martin said.
This bowl thing does put us in the same place at the same time, touching the same object.
True, Philip allowed. But all the same, this doesn't feel threatening to me.
Me either. Still, this could be dangerous.
Agreed,
Philip said, before yelling,
Okay, Gary, you can come up now.
Gary, Tyler, Jeff, and Roy took shelter behind Philip's beloved Pontiac. Even though it was from the 80s, it was the most advanced car Roy had ever seen. He was not impressed.
It looks like a doorstop. It's about as mechanically sophisticated as one, too,
Jeff said as they took up their positions, cowering behind the car. Like any Fiero owner, Philip had learned to ignore such comments. He and Martin stood in the middle of the room. Philip held the bowl in one arm, the disc in the other. Philip asked,
You ready for this, Martin?
Martin answered, Not really, but we're gonna do it, aren't we? Philip said,
Yes, yes we are.
He placed the disc in the bowl, then held the bowl up so Martin could help support it. Soon they were each holding the bowl with two hands, as the picture had demonstrated. For a moment, nothing happened. Then the rim of the bowl glowed a vibrant bluish-green. A pulse of light traveled the entire radius of the bowl, glowing brighter wherever Philip and Martin were touching it. The pulse subsided, and the disc lying in the center of the bowl glowed and lifted into the air just above the bowl's rim. A shaft of blue-green light projected upward from the disc, grew more diffuse, then coalesced into the figure of a person who stood facing Philip. It was a young female with short hair, large eyes, and an impish smile.
Hello, Philip,
the hologram said.
Hello, Gwen,
Philip replied. After a pause, Gwen said,
This is a recording. I can't actually hear you.
In spite of himself, Philip said,
No, sorry.
After another pause, Gwen said,
Don't be embarrassed. I hope you're well.
Behind the Fiero, Roy whispered,
Who's that?
Jeff said,
Gwen, female wizard. She used to live here. She and Martin kinda had a thing.
Tyler added,
Martin had most of it. Then she took off for Atlantis.
The image of Gwen didn't show color, but her flared, sleeved, hooded cloak was all too familiar. Beneath it she wore what appeared to be a lightweight dress and sandals. Gwen's posture stiffened, as if she were starting into a rehearsed speech, which it immediately became apparent she was.
Philip, as chairman of your colony of time travelers, you are invited to attend a summit to be held here, at the sunken city of Atlantis. You will meet with the leaders of all the other known colonies. Together we'll try to create a solid foundation upon which to build our mutual future. The topics of discussion will include chronological pollution, the ethical treatment of non-time travelers, and prevention of the abuse of our shared power. This invitation has been extended to you and a second representative.
Olo Gwen jerked a thumb over her shoulder, as if indicating something behind her.
Specifically, it's been asked that you bring Martin.
She looked back over her shoulder and smirked at Martin, then turned her attention back to Philip.
This is not a command. This is a request. You may choose to decline this invitation, but you won't. Regardless of whether you attend or not, you are welcome to keep this bowl as a token of Atlantis's goodwill. It is made of solid, molecularly pure diamond, the hardest material on Earth. It is also dishwasher safe. You can give the disc to Martin. Maybe he can use it as a paperweight or something. When you're ready to depart, you and Martin are to recite the following phrase in unison. Transporto unau Atlantis cum veno. At which point you'll be transported here to the sunken city of Atlantis, just in time for the beginning of the summit. You will be here for 2 weeks. It'll be warm. Pack accordingly. Also know that I've managed to get the shell program running here in addition to the system the Atlanteans already had in place. So all of your existing powers will work.
Martin leaned to the side to make eye contact with Philip, who looked just as surprised as he was. Holographic Gwen glanced back over her shoulder to where she assumed Martin would be standing. She said,
That concludes the official message. I'm adding this last part because I know the two of you won't be satisfied if I don't.
Gwen turned so that both Martin and Philip could see her in profile. She took a deep breath, put the hood up on her cloak. She looked from side to side in an exaggerated pantomime of fear, then said,
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
With that, she bent at the waist, mimed putting a card into a slot, then disappeared. The glowing disc went dark, wobbled for a second, then fell into the bowl, creating one last ringing noise. The three wizards and one trainee who had been hiding behind the car stood up.
"So, when do we leave?"
Gary asked.
"You leave immediately," Philip said, "and go home. Martin and I will probably leave for Atlantis in a couple of days. We need time to prepare and think things through."
Martin nodded.
"Sounds good."
Gary agreed.
"Yeah, that'll give you time to decide that you have to bring me along."
Tyler said,
"Gary, give it up. You or Gwen, they just want Martin and Philip."
"But they've gotta take me with them."
Jeff asked,
"Why's that?"
Gary was clearly amazed that he had to explain something so obvious.
"Because,"
Gary said,
"I really want to go."
He turned to Philip.
"Please, Phil, please take me with you. I want to see the ladies. I like the ladies."
Philip shook his head.
"No way, you're not coming."
"Philip, it's not fair,"
Gary whined.
"Think of the ladies."
"I am," Philip said. "Guys who act like you're acting are part of what they created Atlantis to get away from."
"And you're gonna let them get away with that?"
Gary's voice grew louder. He was almost manic.
"They'll have forgotten how to deal with suave guys like me. It'll be like shooting fish in a barrel. Only instead of fish, it'll be ladies. And instead of shooting them, I'll be..."
"Yes, we know what you think you'll be doing,"
Philip interrupted.
"And instead of in a barrel, it'll be..."
"Shut up," Philip said. "You're not coming. That's final."
"Fine,"
Gary seethed.
"I'll stay here. You two keep all the ladies for yourselves."
Roy had been making an effort to listen more than he talked, which doesn't come naturally when you seem to be older than everyone around you by at least 20 years. Now he couldn't contain himself. He had to figure something out. He turned to Gary and said,
"Say the ladies again."
"The ladies."
Roy shook his head and repeated,
"The ladies."
Gary smiled and repeated,
"The ladies."
"Why do you say it like that?"
"Like what?"
Roy said,
"It's like you're talking in italics."
Gary arched an eyebrow.
"Italics?"
7. Two kinds of people spend time in police interrogation rooms. Cops, who have a suspect, and suspects the cops have. As such, interrogation rooms usually contain people who are happy to be there, sitting across a table from people who are unhappy to be there. Today was no exception. Agent Miller sat down sullenly, took a moment to scowl at his partner, Agent Murphy, who glanced blearily back at him. Miller turned to the man across the table and growled,
"Well, here we are."
"Yes,"
Jimmy said, smiling broadly.
"Thanks for coming. I really appreciate it."
The two agents exchanged a look that was like stepping on a Lego, quick and unpleasant. Agent Miller adjusted the frilly shade of the oversized decorative table lamp that had been scrounged from somewhere to provide light when the overhead fluorescence mysteriously conked out. Agent Miller opened the manila file folder that was sitting on the table and started reading aloud.
"James Jimmy Sadler, 62 years old. He graduated from Caltech with a solid C average and got a job at Intel. You came under scrutiny in 1986 when irregularities were found in your personnel file. Specifically, you were shown to have been given a promotion that nobody remembered giving you. Shortly after the investigation began, you disappeared without a trace. You finally turned up yesterday, here, at the headquarters of the Seattle PD, where you asked to speak with us."
Jimmy beamed and said,
"Yes, I wanted..."
Agent Miller cut him off.
"Shut up, Jimmy. I wasn't done telling my story. I was going to say, before you so rudely interrupted me, that the Seattle PD called our office. Our office then had to call us, because we weren't in our office. Would you like to know where we were, Jimmy?"
Jimmy said,
"Yes,"
his smile fading slightly.
"We were at the airport,
You see, we'd just gotten off of a plane from Seattle. So instead of going home like we wanted to, we had to hop right back on a plane. Now Jimmy did lose his smile, replacing it with a well-practiced look of regret.
Oh, I'm sorry. I hoped to get you before you went back home. I figured you'd be here a few days, investigating.
Agent Miller's eyes narrowed into slits.
Jimmy, do you know who we work for?
Jimmy shrugged.
The American taxpayers?
Miller scowled.
No. Well, yes, in a sense. But in a much more direct sense, we work for the U.S. Treasury Department. Do you know what the U.S. Treasury Department's job is, Jimmy?
To investigate?
Agent Miller cut him off again.
To be tight with money. That's what the Treasury does. It obsessively tracks every penny of the taxpayers' money. Do you suppose they feel like spending a lot of money doing it?
Jimmy nodded.
No, I suppose.
No, they don't, Jimmy!
Miller bellowed.
No, they don't. So what do you think of the odds of them paying for hotel rooms for Murph and me to use while we stay here in Seattle investigating, when they could just let the local authorities do it instead while they make Murph and me fly home stacked like cordwood in the coach section of the cheapest flight to L.A.?
Miller stood and loomed over Jimmy.
We didn't have any time to do anything yesterday. We flew to L.A., checked our phone messages, hung around the airport for 2 hours, then flew right back here. The only bright point was when we stopped off at that fish market they got here before we went to the airport.
Oh!
Jimmy said brightly.
The one where they throw those great big fish around?
Yeah, that's the one.
Agent Miller said wearily.
How was it?
Jimmy asked.
It was a fish market. You've been to a fish market, haven't you, Jimmy? It was exactly like that, only crowded, and with guys yelling and throwing around a big dead fish. Does that sound like fun, Jimmy? How they ever convince people that that's a tourist attraction is beyond me. It's all a big sham. I'm pretty sure they kept throwing the same fish around no matter what anyone ordered.
Miller sat down in his chair, breathing heavily. He exchanged a look with Agent Murphy, who shrugged. Finally, Agent Miller said,
There was a place that sold tiny little donuts. Those were really good.
After a carefully timed silence, Jimmy leaned forward in his seat and said,
Look, gentlemen, I apologize. If I'd realized you'd lose a day of productivity over this, I'd have contacted you faster. That said, you are here now, and we can help each other.
Agent Miller snorted.
Jimmy, I can see how we'd be in a position to help you, but how can you possibly help us?
Jimmy said,
Yesterday, you tried to apprehend Martin Banks. He got away. I'm betting that in the process he did at least one thing that you cannot explain. Knowing him, probably more than one.
The agents made eye contact. Then Miller said,
And you're saying that you have information about Mr. Banks's whereabouts?
I can't tell you where Martin is now, but I can tell you where he went, and more important, I can show you how he went there.
Agent Miller hid his excitement, which to Jimmy was a more obvious sign of excitement than excitement itself.
Okay,
Agent Miller said.
What do you want in return for this information? Immunity?
Jimmy said,
I don't need immunity. I haven't been charged with anything, and anything I might have done happened 30 years ago. The statute of limitations has to be up by now. If I did anything illegal, which I did not, even the thing I'm going to show you is not, strictly speaking, illegal.
Miller shook his head.
You say you're going to show us what the Banks kid did, right? Well, he escaped from police custody after somehow depositing tens of thousands of dollars into his bank account that he didn't earn. How could he have done any of that legally?
Jimmy hadn't known the particulars of how Martin came to the attention of the authorities. He was amused, but not surprised by what he heard. Jimmy explained.
It's not illegal because of how Martin got the money.
Miller leaned in closer and asked,
How's that?
Jimmy leaned in and quieted his voice as well.
Through means that the lawmakers never thought was possible.
And that is?
Agent Miller prodded.
What I will show you.
Jimmy prodded right back.
So what's in this for you?
Miller asked.
The knowledge that I've done my civic duty.
Jimmy answered, It was a transparent lie. Jimmy designed it to be. Men like Agents Miller and Murphy were used to dealing with untrustworthy people. Sincerity would have only confused them. The only way to truly gain their trust was to confirm that he was what they expected, untrustworthy. Jimmy let Miller stare him down for several seconds before making a show of squirming a bit and admitting in a slightly higher-pitched voice,
"And I'll need a few things. A place to stay, some food, a computer."
Miller leaned back and laughed.
"Ha! Old man, how are we supposed to sell our superiors on that?"
"Tell them you believe I have information that will help you explain what happened yesterday, and in numerous other unsolved embezzlement and bank fraud cases that have ended in mysterious disappearances over the last 3 decades.
Agent Miller considered this, then said,
"Yeah, they might cough up a few bucks if I said that. The problem is I don't think I will, because like you said, I'd have to believe that you have the information you claim, and I haven't seen anything to convince me of that."
"Haven't you?"
Jimmy asked.
"Didn't you notice the big ugly lamp sitting on the table in front of you? Don't you think it's odd that the fluorescent lights have stopped working in only this room, or that they continue to not work after the janitor put in new bulbs? Did anybody mention that they had to keep me in an unused office because the electronic locks on the doors of the holding cell wouldn't work, or that they couldn't take my mugshot because the digital camera died?"
Jimmy paused for effect, then asked,
"Say, have you checked your cell phone messages?"
Agent Murphy pulled his phone from his pocket, looked at it, pressed a button, then showed the phone to Agent Miller, who said,
"Turn it on."
Agent Murphy said,
"I can't."
Miller and Murphy excused themselves and left the room. Jimmy looked at his reflection in the large mirror that took up most of the interrogation room's far wall. On the other side of the one-way glass, Agent Murphy checked the video camera they had set to record just before having Jimmy brought into the interrogation room.
"I'll be darned. It's dead,"
Murphy said.
"You don't have to sound so excited about it,"
Agent Miller grumbled.
"Yeah, I kinda do," Murphy said. "This could be the break we've been waiting for. If he can explain how the bank's kid got all that money, then disappeared into thin air twice, he might be able to help us figure out all the other stuff we can't explain."
Miller sighed.
"Murph, just 'cause we can't explain why your camera isn't working—"
"Or Seattle PD's camera,"
Murphy interrupted. Miller said,
"Yeah."
"Or their electronic locks."
"Okay."
"Or my phone."
"Whatever, that—"
"Or the lights."
"Shut up!"
Miller barked, loud enough that Jimmy jumped in the next room.
"Just 'cause we can't explain him doesn't mean he can explain all the other stuff we can't."
That was the real heart of Agent Miller and Agent Murphy's problem. There was far too much that they could not explain. When they had been officially made a 2-man investigative task force, they had thought it was a promotion, until they came to fully understand their assignment. Miller and Murphy were tasked with investigating obvious cases of embezzlement where there was no actual evidence of embezzlement. Anytime anyone in the United States turned up with a large sum of cash and the local authorities couldn't figure out where it came from, Miller and Murphy would be brought in. It was like trying to catch murderers without ever finding a body. They had spent the last several years receiving random calls from detectives who always sounded delighted to get the case off of their hands, then dropping everything and flying, which cost the Department of the Treasury nothing, because the airlines could deduct the ticket cost from their taxes. Coach, because airlines could give free flyers their worst seats and upgrade 2 paying customers. To wherever there was a lack of evidence for them to collect. Miller and Murphy desperately wanted out of the task force, but leaving it would look terrible on their records and would compromise their chances of future promotion. What was worse, every passing day brought them closer to the inevitable moment when they would be removed from the task force involuntarily. Whatever assignment they were given after a solid record of high-profile failure, they were sure it would not be pleasant. Miller looked through the one-way glass at the man his partner thought might be the key to their salvation. Jimmy was sitting alone, smiling into the mirror.
I don't trust him,
Miller said.
Neither do I,
Murphy agreed.
But I don't think he's lying.
Miller nodded.
That's just because he hasn't really told us anything yet.
After several minutes, Agents Miller and Murphy returned to the interrogation room.
Okay, Miller said. That's an impressive trick.
I know it is,
Jimmy replied. He gestured toward the mirror.
It's a shame the video camera you have back there didn't catch it.
Shut up,
Agent Miller said. A thick silence descended while Jimmy waited for Agent Miller to say what Jimmy always knew he eventually would.
Okay, Miller said. What will you need?
Jimmy said,
nothing fancy. A clean place to sleep, 3 meals a day, and we'll need a computer with high-speed internet access.
Miller nodded.
I suppose you'll need the computer to be in your room.
No,
Jimmy said.
I won't be touching the computer. I don't want it anywhere near me, but we'll need it.
8. For 3 days, Martin and Philip were quite busy. There were preparations to be made, and the fact that neither of them was sure what those preparations were did not make matters easier. They thought that a first-of-its-kind leadership summit in Atlantis sounded like a big deal. They knew that they were representing their friends. They were absolutely sure that there would be many women. Martin could hardly think about anything beyond the fact that Gwen was certain to be there. They each went back to their own original times for a serious makeover. Eddie, Jimmy's former right-hand man, turned out to be very helpful in this endeavor. They had all been loath to trust him after Jimmy tried to kill everyone, but then again he had tried to kill Eddie as well. Besides, in the 2 months since that incident, Philip and Martin had gotten to know Eddie pretty well, and it turned out he was a really interesting guy, and obsessive about men's fashion. He showed them that by jumping to moments in time, spaced several months apart. A wizard could get premium bespoke tailoring done instantly, from the wizard's point of view. They each bought new black tuxedos, which were timeless. They got new suits, which were carefully chosen to look dignified, and as such, were not terribly dated. They got casual wear and swimsuits. It was Atlantis, after all. Which couldn't help being a bit dated. And haircuts, which virtually screamed, I'm from the year I'm from. Philip decided that for the brief period he'd be gone, he would leave Tyler and Eddie to manage his chairmanly duties. It wasn't difficult. Essentially, he told Eddie to do what he always did and report periodically to Tyler. He told Tyler to be available to listen to Eddie's reports. On a certain level, Philip liked the idea that he was leaving medieval England in the hands of a black man and an Asian man. Martin felt bad about not being able to complete Roy's training. He especially felt bad when Roy seemed happy about the situation, eagerly suggesting that Jeff take over as trainer. Gary moped around for a day or so, angry that Philip and Martin weren't letting him tag along. But then he and Martin hit on the idea of planning a grand entrance.
Look, Martin said, this is the first time representatives from all the wizard communities have ever gotten together in one place. We want everyone to know that we've arrived.
Philip said,
they'll know that because they'll see that we've arrived.
Martin shook his head.
No, Phil, you're looking at this all wrong. This isn't just a bunch of people showing up for a meeting.
That's exactly what it is,
Philip said.
No, it's not,
Martin said before pausing, then adding,
well, okay, it is, but it also isn't.
Philip asked,
did that sentence make sense to you when you planned it in your head, or do you just open your mouth and let the words fall out however they like?
Martin took a moment to rephrase his thoughts.
It isn't just a bunch of people arriving for a meeting. It's also a group of important people greeting the world on behalf of their communities. It's like the opening ceremony of the Olympics,
Philip said.
I was thinking it'd be more like a meeting of the UN.
Gary said,
really? I was picturing the Triwizard Tournament from Harry Potter. Yeah, we know you were.
Martin muttered. Then to Philip, he said,
look, I've given this some thought, and I think we need to make a big entrance, okay? Will you just go with me on this?
Fine,
Philip said, just not wanting to argue about it.
Olympic opening ceremony, whatever. Are you suggesting that we wear track suits and walk in a circle carrying a flag?
Martin and Gary looked at each other. Martin said,
You know, that would be funny.
Gary said,
No, you need something impressive, something that'll grab people's attention.
Philip suggested,
How about if we, two grown men, appear out of thin air, looking like responsible, rational adults?
Gary said,
That's a start, but picture this. Two full-grown men, as you say, crawl out of a fiery crack in the ground, spewing brimstone and damned souls.
Is the crack in the ground spewing brimstone, or are we?
Gary said,
We can try it each way and keep whichever looks better.
I see what you're saying, guys,
Philip said,
but surely in a situation like this, less is more.
Yes,
Gary agreed.
And if less is more, then logically more must be even more than that.
Eventually, Philip surrendered. He told Gary and Martin to do what they liked, but he begged them not to make it too ostentatious. Gary's promise to make it just ostentatious enough did not make Philip feel better. Finally, the time came. Their suitcases were packed and in hand. Philip's was a hard-sided, chocolate-brown Samsonite. Martin's was a black fabric rolling upright. Their hair was perfectly styled. Martin's was spiky and crisp. Philip's was impeccably feathered and parted down the middle. They were ready to go. The guys all gathered at Martin's warehouse to see them off.
Okay, everyone, Philip said. We'll be back in exactly 2 weeks.
Yeah, why's that, kid?
Roy asked. Being in his 60s, Roy delighted in calling Philip kid. Being in his 40s, Philip delighted in finally having someone around who could plausibly call him kid.
Why come back in 2 weeks? You're time travelers. Why not just come back the second after you left?
Four quick trips we usually do, Philip explained. But sometimes, for longer trips, it's just less confusing this way. Besides, when you've lived in the past for a while, you begin to realize that you don't particularly need to see all of it.
Martin asked Gary, Is our entrance ready?
Yep,
Gary said.
I've got the macro set up so that it'll automatically trigger off the same phrase that transports you there.
Do I have to do anything special?
Philip asked.
No, Gary said. We've designed the whole thing around the idea that you're going to stand there like a stiff.
Wise,
said Philip. Tyler asked Martin,
What you playing with Gwen?
Martin said,
I'm going to try to be cool.
It occurred to Philip that the phrase try to be cool could mean try to act like everything is all right, which would be good. Or it could mean try to act like I'm a really cool guy, which would be disastrously bad. Goodbyes were exchanged. Instructions were imparted. Stern warnings were leveled at Gary. It was time to go. Martin and Philip stood side by side, staffs in one hand, suitcases in the other, and in unison said,
Transporto unao, Atlantis cum veno!
Many, many years before, and many, many miles away, two figures materialized. It was impossible to identify them further because they were cloaked in shadow, despite the bright sun that shone overhead. For a moment, the incongruously shady duo stood motionless. Then they were bathed in brilliant light, making it easy to identify them as Martin and Philip. Philip winced in the blinding light, shielding his eyes. Martin leapt into the air, much higher and more gracefully than he'd ever been able to without magical assistance. He executed a perfect roundhouse kick, a feat that was all the more impressive for his still holding his staff in one hand and his full suitcase in the other. At the apex of his jump, he froze, motionless in midair. As he hung there, the vista behind him was filled with images of explosions, bloodthirsty orcs, and what appeared to be a white Pontiac Fiero jumping a ravine. Both Martin and the tableau held their position behind Philip for a moment, giving the intended audience the impression that they were looking at the poster for an action-packed buddy movie about a kung fu wizard frequent flyer and his straight-laced, confused partner. From somewhere, an electric guitar solo played. Then the images of cheesy B-movie awesomeness disappeared. Martin landed on the opposite side of Philip from where he started. With a carefully practiced air of nonchalance, Martin lifted his gaze to receive the audience's reaction to their entrance. Martin saw the bluest sky he'd ever seen, above the bluest ocean he'd ever seen. To his right, there was a lush green forest of palm trees and scrub grass. Beneath his feet was sand, the color and consistency of sugar. Directly in front of him, he saw Gwen, standing alone, barefoot on the beach. Her hair was still cut in a cute bob, but exposure to the sun had bleached it a lighter brown than he remembered. She was wearing a hooded cloak of the same design as the one she'd worn when she lived in England, but this one was made of a light fabric, more appropriate for protecting the wearer from the sun than from wind and rain. Beneath the cloak she wore a light, knee-length sundress. Her sandals hung by their loops from her fingers, but her hands were still unencumbered enough to execute a perfect slow clap. Philip cried, "Gwen!" He dropped his suitcase and rushed forward, seizing Gwen in a bear hug.
"Philip,"
Gwen said,
"it's so good to see you."
As they hugged, Martin set down his suitcase and approached for his turn to say hello. The hug finally ended, but rather than release Gwen, Philip held her at arm's length and looked her up and down.
"Gwen, you look great,"
Martin silently agreed. She thanked Philip as he finally released his grip. Martin moved in for a hug of his own, but was stopped dead when Gwen offered him a handshake. With great effort, he shook her hand without any sign of disappointment.
"Gwen,"
Martin said,
"it's great to see you."
"You too, Martin. Clearly you got the ball okay."
"Oh, yeah. Thanks for the Star Wars reference, by the way."
Gwen smiled.
"Don't mention it."
Philip, now done greeting Gwen, had turned his attention to their surroundings.
"Gwen, this is beautiful. Where are we?"
"This is an island a few miles off the coast of Greece. It's the year 368 BC, if you can believe it. Some of the other delegates were given transport coordinates directly into the city, but I wanted some time to say hello and explain a few things."
She started walking down the beach. The two men walked with her. Philip said,
"First things first. How are you, Gwen? How do you like living in Atlantis?"
Gwen said,
"Atlantis is amazing. You'll see soon enough. It's not perfect, but it's pretty close."
Martin said,
"Really? Because I gotta say, I was surprised to hear from you again so soon."
"What do you mean?"
Gwen asked.
"Oh, just that when you left, I figured we'd hear from you again, but I expected it to take a lot longer. I thought you'd hold out longer than a month or two."
Martin looked at Gwen. She was looking back, but she was not smiling. Beyond her, Martin could see Philip. His eyes were bulging, and he was gritting his teeth.
"It's been a month or two for you, Martin," Gwen said. "I've been here over 2 years.
Martin stopped walking. Gwen and Philip did not.
"Oh,"
Martin said.
"That's closer to what I expected."
Gwen neither slowed down nor said a word. Philip looked back at him and chuckled mirthlessly. After a moment, Martin ran to catch up.
"So,"
Philip said, breaking the silence,
"where are we going?"
"To Atlantis,"
Gwen answered.
"It's a few miles away, but I've got a boat to take us."
"Why don't we just fly there?"
Martin asked.
"Because we can't really talk while we're flying, and there are a few things you need to know."
As they rounded a bend, skirting the edge of the island, they saw a wooden dock extending off of the beach and into the water.
"Where shall we start?"
Philip asked.
"Let's start with the summit,"
Gwen said.
"As the invitation said, representatives from each colony of time travelers have been brought here. We've brought two members from each group, the group's leader and another, usually either the second in command or the leader's best friend. It may please you to know that you're from one of the largest groups. Most colonies are quite a bit smaller.
Martin asked, what are the biggest ones?
Well, there's you guys, because you represent all of Europe in one of the most obvious time frames. China and Baghdad are about the same size as yours, but the biggest is Atlantis.
Really? Martin said. Atlantis is the biggest?
Think about it,
Gwen said.
We have most of the women from most of the groups. Of course we'd be the biggest.
Martin held up his hand, signaling surrender.
No, I get it. You've got a point. I just hoped that other cultures were a little friendlier to women who do magic, so maybe they wouldn't feel the need to come here.
Gwen said,
sadly, life is pretty nasty for women who do magic almost everywhere, and in almost any time. The only place where they get treated the same as the men is in the colony that's living as gypsies in Paris in the 1480s, and that's just because the locals treat the male and the female gypsies equally badly.
They walked quietly for a moment, contemplating human nature, until Gwen broke the silence.
So we'll be deciding various issues that face our kind, how to prevent the abuse of our powers, what we will call ourselves, that sort of stuff.
What's wrong with calling ourselves wizards? Martin asked.
We don't all pose as wizards. There are fakirs, philosophers, wise men, alchemists, medicine men, sorcerers, and a couple of magicians. You'll be meeting people like us from all over the world, and all over recorded history. For now, we're using time travelers, but that doesn't really cover it. In Atlantis, we call ourselves sorceresses.
Because you're all women.
And because it's fun. It kind of makes everything into a tongue twister. Send several sorceresses south, see?
Philip said,
great. 2 weeks of planned disagreements with people who aren't used to dealing with equals. It'll be a miracle if we get anything accomplished.
It won't be a problem,
Gwen said.
Our leader, Britt, will be running the show. She's pretty good at this sort of thing.
It's a shame your leader has to do that instead of acting as a delegate for Atlantis.
Gwen laughed.
Oh, she's also one of our delegates.
Wait,
Philip said.
Isn't anyone worried that she might somehow, I don't know, favor herself?
Gwen said,
believe me, it's not a problem. She seldom agrees with herself. Here's the boat.
Gwen gestured toward the end of the dock, which seemed at a glance to have no boats moored to it. When Philip and Martin actually looked, though, they could see another transparent bowl bobbing in the water. This one was much larger than the one Philip had received. Even knowing it was there, it was more visible for the shadow it cast and the furrow in the water where it sat than for actually being visible itself. If Martin squinted, he could just make out a transparent floor and a shelf-like bench wrapping around the inside. Gwen walked to the end of the dock, slipped on her sandals, and stepped over the rim into the near-invisible boat. Martin and Philip followed suit. When they were all seated, Gwen said,
take me home.
The boat silently lifted a foot or so above the surface and started moving, fast enough to make real progress, but slowly enough that the wind was not unpleasant. Philip looked at the edge of the flying bowl boat and asked,
is this made of diamond too?
Gwen smiled.
Yeah, it's laid down one molecule at a time by an automated algorithm. Makes incredibly strong structures, and if you think it through well enough, you can make almost anything. Also, because they're so molecularly pure, you can manipulate, levitate, or teleport them at will with no danger of them breaking apart. It was one of the Brits' first great innovations.
Philip puffed up a bit with nationalistic pride.
We Brits invented this! Ah, when?
Gwen chuckled.
Not the British, the Brits. Two of our leaders are named Brit.
Oh,
Martin said.
Like the Magnuses.
No,
Gwen said.
Nothing like the Magnuses. This is one of the things I wanted to warn you about.
Gwen sighed heavily, thought for a moment, then plunged ahead.
See, there are three people in charge of Atlantis. They form a sort of voting council. There's the president, whom we all elect. At the moment, it's a woman named Ida. Then there's Brit, our real leader. She founded Atlantis and is the smartest person I've ever met. She's there out of respect. She built the whole place herself. She's just amazing, you'll see.
Martin said,
And the third, the other Brit, what's her deal?
Gwen winced.
See, that's the hard part to explain. There is no other Brit. It's the same Brit. Brit is two people. Or you could say she's one person twice. See, Brit went back in time, like 100 years ago, and built Atlantis. She designed it, did all of the engineering, made it all work. Then she went out into the world and encouraged people to move to the city and populate it. They set up homes and businesses, gave her creation life, and made it a real city. She built the buildings, then she made it into the city it is today.
She sounds great,